I just want your best answer.
Well, I don't have to give you crap because I'm perfectly sane.
Hello, everybody. This is Again With This Melrose Place. Today's episode is Season 3, Episode 3, In-Laws and Outlaws. And now here are your hosts, Tara Ariano and Sarah D. Bunting.
Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Tara and Dave. So, Again With This, episode 25 is dropping December 4th. Let's watch Marcia Cross's debut episode of Everwood.
Woo!
The episode is called My Brother's Keeper, which I guess this is like TV law, that if your show is on long enough, you must use that title for an episode. Anyway, that is season 2, episode 3 of Everwood, and it is available for purchase at the usual places or to stream on IMDb TV for free. I have never attempted to do this. I don't know if it's a membership thing. Anyway, if you don't feel like paying, that's where it is. And where you can find our coverage of that is, of course, at patreon.com/againwiththis.
Nice. I don't think I've ever seen that one, although I did watch Everwood, so I look forward to revisiting it. Thanks for that pick, Sarah.
I have no memory of it at all, but I remember Patch Abbott being like constantly infuriated by her, which will be amusing because Tom Amandus is the best part of that show. So I'm looking forward to it.
I do remember that when she was cast, I thought it was funny because at the time, FameTracker.com was still extant. And I had done a 2 stars, 1 slot of Marcia Cross and Brenda Strong.
Sure.
Who played dead wife of Dr. Andy. Yep. So it seemed fitting that Marcia Cross should be his new love interest since, you know, that's his type.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get into this episode, starting with our D plot. Reed's parents show up to bug Joe. Can we talk a little bit about how they decided Joe was going to start showing and now she's just showing all over the place because it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
She's in overalls. She's there's a knock at the door. She walks over. She's got like the pregnant lady hand on the small of her back. Like, oof.
Yeah.
It's just we get it. You're pregnant. We know. We've been knowing. Anyway. The people at the door are Reed's parents. His dad is Deep Throat from season 1 of The X-Files. His mom is an actress named Penny Fuller, also a Hey, It's That Lady, who I know best as the second of the 3 women who played Jamie's mother on Mad About You. Why so many? I don't know. Anyway.
She also played, speaking of Deep Throat, in All the President's Men, she played Sally Aiken.
Get out of here!
Yeah.
Amazing. So they found Joe's name on the papers pertaining to Reed's death. Yeah, I bet they did when she was tried for his murder. It's a weird way to put it. Anyway.
Where were you when he was haunting her and all of us?
Yeah, where were you when she was on trial? Anyway, Mr. Carter says they wanted to call, but she wasn't listed, which, you know, how did you find her then? Anyway, also, how did Sarah's shitty boyfriend get her number to harass her, which I believe I brought up at the time? Anyway, they came to visit Reed's grave, Popper's grave, and wondered if she had some pictures or mementos. And she lies that she doesn't think she does. They realize Reed was not a great guy, but they still love him. And Joe mumbles that, of course, they do. Mr. Carter tells her where they're staying in case she wants to come and see them and adds that they deeply apologize for what Reed put her through, which is a very euphemistic way of saying it. And instead of accepting the apology or not, she just says goodnight and they take the hint and leave. But the next day, Joe brings a framed photo of Reed on the boat. Mr. Carter grumbles that it was the drugs that made Reed behave the way he did. But he wrote them to say how he felt about her. So, like, in the middle of doing all his crimes, he took time out to write his parents a letter. Okay. Seems very out of character, but fine,
perhaps
I guess.
Perhaps he typed it in Geneva font and had Mrs. Walsh post it.
It's a very weird detail.
Yeah. Before he was done away with by Josephine. Oh, Hello.
Thank you. It's really strange. Like, tell us more about your epistolary relationship with your weird son.
Okay. Oh, epistolary.
Anyway, Joe's like, all righty then, and has just pushed herself up with a grunt because pregnant, and is waddling toward the door because pregnant. When Mrs. Carter asks how far along she is, not rudely, although, you know, it's always rude. Do not ever ask this. Wait for the person to volunteer this information. Just a PSA from me to you. Joe's obviously taken aback, even though she's been telegraphing how pregnant she is, and says about 6 months, which is funny because she just started showing last week and is still barely showing. Like, that's not 6 months of pregnancy pad, but fine.
No.
Anyway, this is what ensues. Clip two.
And is it my son's?
No, it's mine.
Oh, of course it is, dear. I guess I was just hoping that if by some miracle it was Reed's, it would give us the chance to turn all this grief over our son into love for a grandchild. A foolish fantasy, I guess.
Well, I wasn't going to say anything. Because frankly, after everything that's happened, I feel it's nobody's business but my own. But, yes, this child was conceived with Reed.
Oh, Joe, God bless you for sharing this with us. You have no idea how much solace this brings.
I feel kind of awkward. I'm not sure what kind of role you'll be able to play in my baby's life.
That's up to you, Joe. Whatever you decide, we'll respect your decision.
Thank you. You're so smart and so strong, Joe. I hope this baby grows up to be just like you.
Please keep in touch. You have our number.
I'll try. I really will.
Very obvious where this is going, but I guess we have to go through all of the motions as if we don't know. So over to the good old what?
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, my neighbors just had a baby like a week ago, and we thought that she was pregnant, but it sort of was like, you know, she wears a certain style of clothing where it's hard to tell. And, you know, we're not trying to like stare through our kitchen window into theirs to
sheer normal
figure it out. And yes. It had been kind of going on for what seemed like a while. And I was like, I'm glad I never said anything.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like dad came home with a little bundle and was like, so, hey, here's Frankie, our new daughter, which is super cute. Congrats. But it was like, I was just thinking, what would have happened if I'd like asked rudely and followed up with, and is it Cameron? Oh my God. Jesus. Like, God. It's really amazing how, soap operas, like the conversations that don't occur until the next time the camera is present, but then they're also really rude. And then no one ever says goodbye on the telephone.
Yeah.
Learn how to human.
Yeah.
Soap opera writers. Yeah. Okay.
So another day over to the good old SBG modeling agency where Joe is shooting when Reed's parents inappropriately show up, apparently not at her invitation based on her reaction. They announce that they want to be there for her. She should call them with anything they need, which they already said in the last scene. We heard it. But this is how they say goodbye. Clip three.
God always has a plan, Joe. And if this is part of it, then far be it from us to question his ways.
Perfect. That's it.
Well, I appreciate the support. Have a nice trip back. You take good care of our baby, dear.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that's the end of that.
Yep.
Dot, dot, dot.
Well, so sometime later, Joe and Allison are having sad salads at Shooters, the normal thing to order at a bar. when a dude rolls up with a folder and is like, Joe Reynolds, and because we've all seen TV, we know where this is going. She's been served by Reed's parents, who are seeking custody of the baby. What a surprise. We do have more to discuss, but first, we have a message from Reva.
If you're conversant with Beverly Hills 90210 and Melrose Place, chances are good that you have also dipped a toe into another show in the Darren Star universe, Sex and the City. If so, Reva Lucia has the companion blog for you, CarrieBradshawIsTheWorst.com.
Reva breaks down each episode of HBO's long-running dramedy with trenchant commentary and relevant gifs, tagging them into categories such as Not Everything Is About You, Don't Stalk People at Church, This Bitch, Your Book Sucks, Your Hair Sucks, and Could You Be More Fucking Selfish?
It's not the only Sex in the City blog you'll find online, but it is probably the only one with a whole section of Times Carrie Needs a Punch in the Face. And that section, really not lacking for entries.
So thank you, Reva, for supporting this podcast. And thank you for reminding the world that Carrie Bradshaw is the worst.com.
It's important work.
It really is. Back to our episode with our C-plot, Brittany's reason for existing is revealed. After sexing up Jake real nice the night before, one assumes, Brittany wakes him up with kisses. He tells her the last few nights have been great, but they aren't what he had planned. She says surprises are what make life so fascinating. But this is one that's badly timed, he says. Before he can properly extricate himself from this situation, though, she puts his her finger on his lips, which is the second time in four episodes that a woman has done that to him in bed, which is funny. says that she'll go out and score them some amazing croissants. That's not how she puts it. That's how I put it.
Thank you for that phrasing.
You're welcome. On her way to the bakery, she stops at Palmer's car, apparently late due to Jake's late sleeping. He wants to get on the boat, but she warns him it's not going to be as easy as he thinks because Jake is trying to get rid of her and he's not as easily manipulated as Palmer told her he would be. But she's having a nice time trying, at least. And some number of nights later, Jake and Brittany have beers on the deck and discuss how good a job she did cleaning up. She hintingly says she's pretty sleepy now, but Jake says he's going to go sleep at his apartment tonight. She says that doesn't sound like an invitation, and he confirms it's not. He reminds her that the offer was only for her to spend a couple of days, but she whines that she didn't know how she was going to feel about him. And he's flattered, but they're going to have to be done now. And she's all, but my husband! And Jake sympathizes, but he can't turn his boat or his life into a halfway house for unhappy wives on the run. She accuses him of having a fear of intimacy, and he's like, that's not going to work either.
Yeah, it's pretty good funny. Line.
So he wishes her luck, advising her to make sure the next rich husband isn't so mean. But so then she starts begging, just a few more days, but it's a no for him, dog. But the next day, she's either still or back on the boat, now with Palmer.
Yeah, he like goes back to his apartment and leaves her there to...
Unclear.
Leave?
I don't know.
No, how it works is it's your boat. You're right. Telling her to go. So stay there until she's gone.
Right. On the other hand,
until she's out of sight and move the boat would be my advice, or sink it, but whatever.
Right. But then on the other hand, like, it's a boat. I don't know why she kept hanging around. Like, just wait for him to leave. Then you also leave or pretend you left. And then, like, everyone around knows you've been staying on the boat. No one's going to think it's weird if you come back. Like, it's not like he's telling all his boat neighbors, hey, she's not allowed to stay here. You know what I mean? Like, you know, yeah. It's not like the gas, it's locked. Like, it seems like a boat is a pretty insecure dwelling. You know? Like, yeah. It doesn't seem like she needed to go to that much effort just to, like, just wait for him to leave and then just climb on, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, because that's what she does with Palmer, as she tells him she did all the prep work she could and wants to know when he's going to get her the plastique. When she hears it'll be another day, she crabs that her patience is wearing thin. He thinks $50,000 up front should buy him some, and it'll be all she gets if she keeps whining. So then they go below decks, and Palmer is a pig. Clip 4.
Come on, let's get out of here. Jake will be back any minute.
Is this where you did it?
Homer, shut up.
Jake must have had a fine time. Can't believe he'd want to give you up. Guess you just couldn't hold his interest. How was he, anyway, Brittany, on a scale from 1 to 10?
Gee, I don't know, Palmer. Why don't you ask your daughter?
And finally, Brittany, like, pays it forward to us for putting up with her boring ass for, like, what seems like 10 weeks. Like,
yeah.
Like, Palmer, shut up.
Yeah.
It's actually pretty good line reading.
That was well good. Also, the ending the conversation with, like, yeah, you're right. I guess I'm not as good at fucking as your daughter. Like, ooh.
Yeah.
He's like, not going to enjoy that.
No. Nor should he. No. This whole thing is extremely weird and boring, and I wish they would get on with it.
Honestly. Well, it's going to be at least one more episode, because that night Amanda's at home with a magazine when there's a knock at her door, and it's her dad. Dun, dun, dun. But that's where we leave it for now.
Who is wearing a blazer so gigantic that he could go on the lam in his own sport coat. It's amazing.
On to the B plot. Allison returns from Wisconsin to a hostile work environment. Oh. So she returns to D&D, heads straight to Amanda's office to tell her and her extremely short skirt, which you can see in the visual aids what there is of it to see, that she's back. She came straight from the airport because she couldn't wait to get back to work, which, by the way, she definitely didn't. We know how time zones work. She was on her way to the airport in bright daylight in Wisconsin. Like, this is the next day. She's in another outfit, blah, 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 whatever. Amanda says she hopes everything went well. And for a change, Allison negs Amanda, clip 5.
Yeah, they did. For once, you gave me some good advice.
So, Allison explains that dealing with her dad and getting everything out in the open freed her emotionally. And then Amanda restores the balance of the universe by negging her back. Clip 6.
I'm sure your shrink will be fascinated with the details.
I love that she just immediately cuts in and is like, I didn't ask for your life story, beesh.
Yeah. Save it all up for the therapist. Crazy. Anyway, that's joke. I know people in therapy are not crazy. Then she walks over to the couch to give Allison the great news. Her ex-fiance is her new colleague. Just the way Amanda frames it, of course, is that D&D got the escapade account thanks to Billy's help and due to his sharing privileged information, and that Bruce was so impressed he offered Billy a job, leaving out the part where Billy's participation in this scheme got him fired. Allison keeps her smile pasted on and goes out to ask Billy how he could make this decision without talking to her. Clip 7.
I did it because while trying to help you land the escapade account, Nancy hires D&D and fires me.
Wait, you didn't do this for me. You did this for Amanda.
No, I did it for you because Amanda assured me that you would get the credit for bringing it in.
Oh, but instead you landed a high-paying senior copywriter's position at my company? Don't you realize how awkward this is going to be for both of us?
No, awkward for me is standing in an unemployment line.
Would you keep your voice down? This is just what I'm talking about.
No, I'm not going to keep my voice down. I'm tired of standing quietly on the sidelines like some patient lovesick puppy while you try and sort out a lifetime of emotional baggage. Allison, I'm sorry for what happened to you. I'm sorry for what you had to go through, and most of all, I'm sorry about us. I've done everything I can to be there for you, at the expense of myself. But from now on, I gotta look out for number one, because I got problems too. And believe it or not, you happen to be the root cause of most of them.
Good luck in your new job.
I mean,
the thing is, no.
Yeah.
I mean, I am aware that this is a soap operatic property. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is what I was talking about before in Ray, people apparently not having phones except when a camera is on it to see one side of the conversation that has exposition we need. Like, they weren't in touch.
Yeah.
After he, like, block tackled her dad? Like,
yeah.
this doesn't make sense is A. B, of all the characters to give a heel turn to, him? Like, yeah. Why? It makes no sense. It shows no long game. And in the hands of this, quote, actor, it's just really, like, I understand what they're trying to do, but there were a dozen other ways they could have done it. And this one is terrible, and it makes me sad for Allison. I don't like that. It's like agreeing with Dylan.
Yeah. I mean, if his argument here is like, you are the root cause of most of my problems, I don't know, maybe don't get a job where she works. That's probably job one, I would think, you know?
Also, like maybe, I don't know, you live together, like...
Yeah. I mean, they are going to hash out where they stand later on, but like the fact that they haven't actually gotten clarity on this prior to this, like it's the same thing that we complained about on 90210, where it's like, are David and Donna dating right now or not? Like, where they would be in one of their, you know, weird fighting half on, half off stages where it's right. Like, what are they even doing? And this is even dumber because they were engaged. Like, I get that he was, I mean, I don't get that he was upset that she wanted to pursue whatever she was doing with her dad, because he should have supported that. Again, yeah. To your point, like the giving him the heel turn at this stage made zero sense and is dumb. But if that was where you were going to leave it, then they had to have had a conversation, or at least given someone exposition at some point where, you know, Allison in Wisconsin was like, well, Billy and I broke up, or Billy is moving out, or something. Like,
yeah, or Billy keeps calling, I refuse to pick up his calls. Right. Like, if he gets sick of dealing with your emotional journey because you're not helping him do that.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
But this is like when Kelly was like, I don't understand why we can't just go back to the way things were. And Brandon's like, because I popped the question and you popped it like a balloon.
Yeah.
So fuck off.
Yeah. I mean, part of that did happen, I guess, when she was in San Francisco and Meredith was like, are you going to call Billy and tell him where you are? But that was like for 2 days, you know? Like, I get.
And they've interacted since then.
Exactly.
He showed up there. Yes. Like, are we to understand that he was like, well, since your father's run off, I guess I'll go sleep in his car? Like, what the fuck?
Right. And they like went back to LA together. They agreed they still wanted to be a couple. They were still going to get married. She just didn't want to do it that literally that day, because they were going to go elope in Las Vegas. And then he was like, well, it's today or never. And then it was like just a million question marks while she was in Wisconsin. And then all this other shit happened with that Amanda set up. Anyway, the end of this scene is also where we see their cubicles are right next to each other, which is hilarious. Like, Amanda, you bitch. I love you.
Oh my God, the D&D HR department needs to be burned to under the ground.
Yes.
So bad. Also, Bruce, what the fuck?
Yeah, Bruce, you're a bad boss. Really?
Yeah, you are not good.
So that night, again, not helping us untangle our confusion at all, Billy wanders into Allison's room in the apartment they still somehow share, as she is getting into bed alone to ask her about Wisconsin. She gives him the abridged version, and he's like, that all sounds great, I guess, and squeezes her shoulder and then says goodnight and leaves. Okay, good job. Good job, guys. So the next day, Allison proves my point in the first escapade strategy meeting. Clip 8.
Thanks to Billy, escapade is on the hook. Now we need to devise the kind of campaign that would distinguish them from the pack of urban magazines.
That's going to be tough. Escapade is a very generic publication.
Generic? What's that supposed to mean?
It doesn't have a strong identity.
That's funny. You never seemed to think that before. But then again, you've been changing your mind about a lot of things lately.
I can't speak for your personal relationship, but when it comes to business, Allison's never been afraid to put her feelings on the table, whether they're popular or not.
Yeah, it's fine, as long as you're honest about what you're feeling.
Billy, Don't make this about us. I'm just trying to do what's best for the account.
Fine. Since apparently that's all you care about.
That's a lie, and you know it.
No, you're a liar and a coward because you don't have the guts to admit that our relationship is dead and you killed it.
I think I'll just leave you two to hash this one out.
I love that. Like, why? They've completely forgotten you're there. Just listen openly. It's so much easier.
Exactly. But what she does instead is the next best thing, which is hit the speaker button on the phone on the way out, as any one of us would, even though it's just these two nitwits and their fight is, like them, extremely boring and stupid. So she accuses Billy of being unprofessional and requests that they discuss this at home. And he's like, home? What's that? So then she's like, all right, we can have it out now. And then she comes around to his side of the table, weirdly moving a chair as though there are not several over there already. And as Amanda parks it in her office and starts eavesdropping, Allison tearfully says Billy wants easy answers to complex situations, but he's not always going to get them. He's immature and selfish. He's immature. He says she's selfish, which they're both right. Frankly, I think that's a fair read on the situation, honestly.
Yeah.
Leaving aside the situation with her dad, that has been true of her in general. He's not going to pine for her until she decides she wants to start loving him again. And she cries that she never stopped. He glares at her hatefully. She's seen the visual aids.
Well, he tries to. She's really good in this scene, Courtney Thorne Smith.
Yes. So he says he doesn't believe it anymore. She's sorry for what happened, but she can't do anything other than what she's doing now. In that case, this is not the time for them to be together, he says. And she accepts that. It was her place first, so he'll move out, he says. And Amanda looks sad but unsurprised in her office. And some number of days later, Allison's at her desk when Amanda comes up to Billy's desk with the apartment application he left in her office so that he could use her as a reference. As Allison eavesdrops intently, Amanda says she can't be his reference because she doesn't want him to move. Billy scoffs at the idea of Amanda wanting to keep Allison and Billy together, but she just hates the idea of losing a great tenant. Plus, she has a vacant apartment in the building. Oh boy, Billy gets to move into the studio, the shitty cursed apartment. Enjoy. Finally, our A-plot, poor Matt gets embroiled in all the Mancini Michigas again. In the crazy house, just kidding, the mental institution, Sydney is wearing a gown, I guess, because she can't be trusted in pants with a tie. And looking at ink blots, her shrink, Dr. Curtis, is played by legendary Hayes, that guy, William Shalhoub, from literally everything. And as we join them, she is serenely saying the ink blot he's holding up looks like an angel. Apparently, that's what she said about the last three. So she shrugs and changes her answer to a field of flowers or maybe a beautiful sunrise. He suspects she is not being entirely candid. She jokes that it must be frustrating for her not to be giving the answers he wants to place her on his loony curve. But he just wants her to be honest. She shoots back that she doesn't owe him anything because she's perfectly sane. He says that's a pity since the courts don't look kindly upon sane women who try to run over their husbands, although he uses the word girls, which if you're talking about a person who's married, maybe that's not the correct term, doctor. But she reiterates her innocence and threatens to shut down his snake pit of a hospital when she gets out and grabs his pad away to read his notes. And as he's threatening to strap her down for their next meeting, he hits a hidden button on the side of his desk. And the orderlies bust in to drag her out as she repeats that she's innocent, and he does not seem convinced. Over to the regular hospital, Kimberly comes in at the end of Michael's appointment with some doctor who's just told him there's no injury to the brain. And she asks to speak to the doctor alone, sends Michael to the hall, ordering him to stay near the door like he's a child. Which is very funny.
She'd have one of those little vests with a leash that clips onto it.
So the door could be closed, but she could still be holding it. Totally. telling this doctor how worried she is about what could happen if she takes her eye off Michael for a second. And this doctor sternly says Michael's a grown adult and that his memory loss is temporary. And she can help him by taking him to his favorite places, cooking his favorite foods and so on, because sensory stimuli can trigger a recurrence of memory. So she immediately goes out to tell Michael she's putting in for a transfer so that she can take him far away from all these awful memories. Love her. Over to the studio where Chris is once again all handsy with Jane in the office, though at least her dress is cute this time, as you can see in the visual aids. It's like a tube dress with a turtleneck. It's all stripey. Love it.
Very cute.
Before telling her that his boss wants to cancel the deal unless they can get Michael to sign off on it by EOB the next day. This is also the first time I noticed that even though the B-roll of the front of Jane's studio is definitely downtown LA or thereabouts, the fake street scene outside of the studio window is 100% New York. You
really?
Can see this in the visual aids. Totally. Yes. It looks like Soho. Yeah, you can see it.
Amazing.
In the visual
aids. She wishes.
No kidding. Anyway, Jane says that Michael is incapacitated. She doesn't know if anyone has power of attorney. If it's Kimberly, she won't be any help. But even if her deal falls apart, Chris would like her to know he still wants to fuck her. Great. That night, Sydney creeps to the rec room payphone and calls Matt. She is barely told him where she is when an orderly finds her and hangs up the phone. And the next morning, Matt goes to Jane's before work to tell her about the call. She's distracted and then, Jane's outfit in this scene. Oh my God. And the next one, she's in a very era appropriate, you know, like tiny rib, long sleeve t-shirt. It's like bright neon teal. But this vest has, it's normal in the front and then like has the tiniest straps you ever did see, like crisscrossed across the back and then tied at the waist. It's insane. Yeah. The straight jacket of vests. You can see it in the visual aids, of course.
This is how we lived. And I think those ties were like a grosgrain.
Oh, yeah, like probably.
Ballet slipper ties. Ugh.
Why?
I don't know.
She looked so good the day before. Jane, why are you backsliding?
I mean, and she's almost like, she can almost get away with that look. But I mean, I don't know. Like it's not for those with a, you know, front porch of any size. So I never attempted it, but
no.
I mean, it's just very, very of its era.
Yeah. It's just so showily nonsense-y. Like there's just no reason for it.
It's like, Jackie's, little Dickies, but not charming.
It's like, you know, the leather harnesses that men wear now sometimes, like that have no function and are just meant to make them look like hard. It's like that, but it's a vest. It's like it also looks as dumb as those harnesses do. Sorry. If you wear them, they're dumb.
Yeah.
Anyway, Jane is distracted and unconcerned about Sydney's claims regarding Kimberly, but says she will assess the situation when she goes to see Michael today. Matt warns her that Michael's not going to recognize her, and that's if she even gets past Kimberly, so he offers to come with her. And Michael is alone at the beach house when Matt and Jane show up. Worriedly, Michael goes full latchkey kid, saying that Kimberly asked him not to let anyone in the house while she's gone. And then he notices Jane and is like, "Who's she?" And she introduces herself and says she was his wife. And he's like, "We were married." I just love how Thomas Calabro is playing brain injured Michael.
Oh my God, like, his face
so
is
sweet.
Adorable. He looks about 11. He's like, "Oh, neat."
Yes.
Oh, buddy.
It's really sweet.
It's cute.
She tells him that she has something important to talk to him about, and he agrees to let them in. And on the deck, Michael says he can't understand how he ever cheated on such a beautiful woman. She tries to get a handle on where she and he stand right now in clip 9.
Do you really mean to tell me you don't remember anything about this?
Nothing. And the way Kimberly describes it, you were some kind of backbiting shrew from whom I was lucky to escape with my reproductive organs intact. But I don't share her impression of you at all.
Interesting.
The euphemism of reproductive organs.
Like, I know.
Really, a very nice detail. Anyway, she's flattered. Yeah. He adds that just being around her fills him with warm feelings. For the first time, he has a sense of himself. And she confirms to his question that they did have good times together and that he destroyed it. So he's sorry for whatever pain he caused her. But there is something he can do. Sign these papers, like he was totally planning to do before the accident, according to her. And he thinks that all sounds great. So while they're talking, Matt looks through the drawers in the bedroom and then finds an extra wig, the backup wig, on a styrofoam head in the bathroom. So outside, Michael finishes signing all the papers. Before Jane goes, he asks, if you don't remember the past, does it still count? And she says, it does. And he's sad, but she says he will go on. For the first time in years, she sees the man she married. And suddenly he remembers that she has ticklish eyelids and that he used to kiss them. And he is doing so while Jane giggles when Kimberly storms around the corner and catches them in clip 10.
Get out.
Kimberly, there's really no need.
Michael, trust me. I don't know what Jane told you, but she is a two-faced, devious bitch who is probably in cahoots with her sister to try to have you killed. That's a lie, Michael.
Jane, let's go.
Matt, didn't I expressly forbid you from coming anywhere near this house? You know, you two ought to be ashamed of yourselves taking advantage of a sick and helpless man. Now leave, both of you, before I get pissed. Bye, Michael. Get well soon.
Feel better, buddy.
Jane, set foot on this property again, I'll have you arrested for trespassing. Understand?
Perfectly. By the way, Kimberly, I guess you didn't make much of an impression. Seems to me the only thing in the world Michael can remember is how much he once loved me.
That's a good line. If only Josie Bassett had another take to like actually deliver it well.
Yeah. Or if you'd given it to Laura Layton. I mean, Here's the thing. Josie Bassett is not bad, but she's not like... giving her zingers is not the play. And
yeah.
This is what happens.
Yeah. You really see in this season so far how much they just don't know what to do with her.
Yeah.
She every scene that she's in feels so extraneous. It's much like the laces on the back of her vest.
Yeah.
At her place that night, Jane serves Chris a home-cooked meal and they toast to signed contracts. He had no idea she was so devious. She claims to feel a little guilty. Michael's changed so much, he lost his mean streak with his memory, she says. Chris says he has no right to stand in the way of her success. And then the phone rings. We only hear her half, and when she hangs up, she tells Chris it was Sydney's lawyer. They struck a deal with the DA's office. If Sydney will confess, they will plead temporary insanity. He could arrange a work release program with psychiatric probation if Jane supplies the job. Jane will do it, of course, but Sydney refuses to admit that she's guilty. So even though, as we said in the last episode, and they said in the last episode, that the mental hospital they were sending Sydney to was called Hidden Hills, this B-roll has a giant, completely legible sign out front that says Suncrest. And also, there's a guy walking by out front. The lapels on his jacket are like 10 feet wide. Like, this is clearly B-roll from 1976. He looks like an extra from Casino. This is so old.
Charlie's Angels B-roll.
It might be. It literally might be.
Oh, my God. That's amazing. Maybe anyway, the Hidden Hills are behind the Sun Crest.
Perhaps. Anyway, you can see this in the visual aids.
Part of the Hidden Hills healthcare system.
Perhaps. So Jane is waiting in an office as a gowned Sydney is let in. If she's being heavily medicated, as one would assume, it is not making a dent. She is staying calm, but she's not compliant and is definitely not cooperating with the guilty plea. So after surgery at the regular hospital, Kimberly's holding court to an entourage when she runs into Matt in the hall. He wants a word in private. She tries to blow him off, but he stands firm, and when everyone else has moved on, he tells her he now believes Sydney's claim that Kimberly was the one who ran Michael over, and they have this exchange, clip 11.
If you start spreading that disgusting theory, I'll slap you with a slander suit that will cost you your job. Understood?
You're awfully touchy for an innocent woman.
You know, personally, Matt, I think you suffer from acute castration anxiety, so you fantasize that all women are murderers. Think about it. The driver of that car was wearing a short blonde wig. Now, how could I get all of this hair under something like that?
Wigging.
Does this answer your question?
You're a dead man, Fielding.
Wig yank, baby, wig yank.
I mean, It's not really okay for him to do, but at least he has something to do.
He does.
Like Matt P.I.
Yeah.
I don't know.
The wig yank obviously is in the visual aids in case you need to use it for some reason. The gates of the crazy house also say Suncrest, by the way, which we see at night, or sun something. That's all we see. Inside, everyone is sleeping as orderly Vincent Schiavelli, as promised by Sarah in our last podcast, sits on Sydney's bed and wakes her up to say this, clip 12.
I'm just keeping an eye on you.
I'm fine. Good night.
You know, it's really nice to have someone around here to look after you.
I can look after myself.
I want to make you my girlfriend, Sydney. My special girlfriend.
You're sick. That'll not happen.
Try that again and I will kill you.
You know, you'd better figure out how things work around here. Because as I understand it, you're checking in for a long visit. And that means lots of playtime, Sydney. And next time, I won't be so gentle. Sleep tight, pretty girl.
I mean, like, I don't argue with the casting or the performances of either actor in the scene, but could we maybe dial it down with the sexual assault storylines just for a week or two?
Yeah.
Please.
Yes. Although, I will say, I do appreciate that they at least were portraying, like, that people who have been arrested sometimes make decisions that are compromised by the fact that they don't feel safe while they're incarcerated, because this is a real thing that happens.
Yep, absolutely.
It's a very, very good episode of Law & Order starring our girl Cara Buono, who's railroaded by Angie Harmon.
Absolutely. I would also say that in institutions such as this, sexual assault is rife because patients are not believed.
Yep.
And I think that one starred, why can't I pull her name? Russian Doll.
Oh, Natasha Lyonne.
Yes.
Yeah. Moving on from the creepiness. The next morning, Matt calls Jane to bring her up to date with the whole wig yank scene. Wig yank, baby wig yank. Jane is not too concerned about it because Sydney confessed and will be out later that day. Matt tries to protest, but Jane wearily tells him to leave it alone. No sooner has he hung up than he runs into Kimberly. He's starting to apologize for his wild imagination when she coos that he needs to remember how dangerous hospitals can be. Just the other day, a nurse stuck herself with an infected needle. Kimberly had the strange premonition that Matt was headed for a terrible accident, so he better watch his step. And then Jane and Chris are at the hospital signing out Sydney. Dr. Curtis warns Jane that he has Sydney on some mild sedatives since she was a little rambunctious earlier. And an orderly, not Vincent Schiavelli, brings Sydney out, docile and smiling, and curious about who Chris is, which, fair. And then the three of them leave, all looking real awkward, to, you know, their new career, all working together. That's going to probably be great for everyone.
Absolutely.
That's where we leave it. Wow. Very, very action-packed episode.
Yeah.
Let's close it up by naming our episode MVP. Boy, I want to say Matt because he actually did get to the bottom of something, but then he ended up backing off, so it's hard to say him.
Yeah. Calabro, why not?
Yeah, I think that's fair. He is, as we said, very fun to watch at this phase of the show and generally, but especially now because it's such a departure.
Yeah, true.
I'll say William Shalhart, even though he's not playing a great character because, you know, we owe him so much in culture.
It's true, we do.
Least valuable player. Billy, really a dick in this episode.
That was not cute at all. It's not his fault, but oof.
Yep, we agreed.
Next time on Again With This, sisters are doing it to themselves. Daddy knows least, and bringing up baby turns into a battle royale, which is what you'll be in with your stomach lining after you check out our visual aids, which we do for every single episode of Again With This. You'll find those on our website, againwiththispodcast.com. That's also where you'll find a link to buy our very special 90210 book, available in all formats. To learn more, follow us on Twitter at AWT90210. And for once, we'll give you some good advice, which is to check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/againwiththis. Tons of extra content, so join today. I'm Unveiled Threat Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. My co-host is Bruce's new favorite, Tara Ariano. She's on Twitter at Tara Ariano. And our producer, David T. Cole, always has a plan. Talk to you next time. Ooh.
What?